You are listening to the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. This month's guest is Dr. Harvey Kleiman, a research scientist in obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive sciences at the Yale School of Medicine. He is also the director of Reproductive and Placental Research Unit with a special interest in infertility and pregnancy complications. He has made major contributions in the field of placental research, and we are grateful that he made time to share his insights on our podcast. Well, Dr. Kleiman, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
It's my pleasure.
My first question for you is, how did you first become interested in this field of placental research?
Well, totally by serendipity, because I don't think anybody by themselves would jump into placental research. So I always knew that I wanted to be a medical researcher, and I sort of started off mentally as thinking I would get a PhD. And as I was doing research in high school and in college, I saw that the PhDs really didn't have as much control over their life as I wanted over my life. And I saw that the doctors, the MDs, actually did have more control. So luckily, around that time, there was the beginning of a program called the MD-PhD program, funded by the National Institute of Health. And I applied for that at the University of Chicago and was lucky enough to get an MD-PhD award. So I was in a seven-year program that combined an MD and a PhD together. And when I did my PhD, which was on red blood cell membranes, very basic science, I finally finished and went back to the clinic, and my favorite thing was obstetrics. I loved delivering babies. I had a great time. The only problem is that the people who were my teachers then really didn't think that a researcher was going to be successful in obstetrics and gynecology, because they said, look, you're going to be on call every third night. You're going to be doing obstetrics for 20 years, and when your patients get older, then you'll do gynecology. So we don't see how you can really do research. So I was disappointed, but I said, okay, I still want to do research. So I chose to go into pathology, which is a field where we study tissues and we do more basic science work. I ended up at University of Pennsylvania, and the problem is that I didn't really get along personally with the pathologists. They were not social enough for me. I missed my patient care experiences. So while I was there, I finished pathology, but I decided to do what's called a postdoctoral research fellowship in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at University of Pennsylvania. And there I was working on the ovary, actually, how the ovary worked. And one day, and this is the serendipitous story, one day the head of the lab, Jerry Strauss, said, Harvey, would you mind taking a picture of a gradient, because we were digesting placentas. We're trying to figure out, you know, what's going on with the placenta. And I said, sure. I was known as a photographer, and I still am. So I took the picture, and I asked Jerry, what are the different bands in this gradient? And he said, I have no idea. We're only doing this to get rid of the red blood cells. So I said, well, would you mind if I started looking at those bands? That looks interesting to me. He said, sure, go for it. So what I discovered by accident was that one of the bands was actually the stem cell. It's sort of like the Lord of the Rings, the ring that controls them all. This is the cell that makes all the other cells of the placenta. And that was a pretty big discovery. I was excited about it, and I shifted my research from the ovary to the placenta, and this was back in the early 80s, and really haven't stopped ever since then. So my entire career changed because somebody asked me to take a picture of something.
That's an unbelievable story, and it sounds like you've been spending the last 35 years of your career devoted to placental research. So based on what you've learned over all these years, we often hear that the placenta can tell the story of the pregnancy. How do you feel about that statement? Do you feel that that is a true statement?
Yes, I look at the placenta as like the rings of a tree. So after the long life of a tree, if you cut a tree down, or hopefully it falls naturally and you look at the rings of the tree, you can see how the tree grew every year, how much water there was, rain there was, nutrition, good times, bad times. And the placenta really is the record of the pregnancy. And as long as we're talking about trees, I think for the audience, I want to sort of draw an analogy. A lot of people think the placenta belongs to mom. They'll say, oh, a baby is born, and then mom's placenta comes out. Well, that's completely incorrect. The placenta is part of the fetus, and the best way for someone to imagine this is to think of a big oak tree with a big trunk and the leaves and the branches above ground, and under the ground is a root system that's as big as the tree is above the ground. And the placenta is the root system for the fetus. So if you think of the leaves and the branches of the fetus and the tree trunk as the umbilical cord, the roots in the ground are the placenta. So likewise, you probably could look at the roots of a tree to see how well it's doing. We can look at the placenta, and most often, 99.99% of the time, we look after delivery. But we can look at the placenta and tell whether there have been problems, whether the fetus has been stressed, when do those things happen, is there something wrong with the development of that fetus and that newborn baby based on just looking at the placenta. So yes, the placenta can definitely tell the story of the pregnancy, and in my opinion, it's the most important thing to look at after the delivery to figure out when things go wrong, especially when there's a pregnancy loss, why that loss occurred.
So with that wonderful tree analogy in mind, and knowing that the majority of the people who listen to this podcast are families who have experienced some sort of loss, how often are stillbirths, neonatal deaths, other poor outcomes related to placenta concerns?
So the vast majority, I mean, I would just take a guess, at least 90%. There are clearly problems, and let's just sort of address them right now and then move on to the placenta. There are problems that happen with fetal development where something doesn't grow normally. But interestingly, those developmental problems, like if a fetus is missing its lungs, for example, now that's a serious problem, and a newborn baby can't survive without lungs, but a fetus can survive without lungs because the placenta basically takes over the function of the lungs. The same thing with cardiac anomalies. There are a lot of fetuses that might have a cardiac anomaly, and yes, it's a serious problem, but it's not going to affect the fetus while it's in utero. It won't even lead to a pregnancy loss, but it will be a serious problem afterwards. Those problems are picked up usually by ultrasound, either at 12 weeks or definitely by 20 weeks. And there's a new field, and this is not the topic of our conversation, but this is what's happening to those fetuses. There's now an increased interest to do actually intrauterine surgery to try to fix those problems. But let's just set those aside and say that those are the minority. The vast majority of problems that lead to an intrauterine fetal demise are related to the placenta and the umbilical cord. And the umbilical cord is the lifeline between the placenta and the fetus, much like you could think of a scuba diver with a tank being the placenta and the hose from the tank to the person's mouth being the umbilical cord. So if there's a kink, for example, in that umbilical cord, that can sadly be very quickly the end of the pregnancy, as an example. But there are many, many things that can cause a pregnancy loss. Most of them are related to the placenta and umbilical cord.
So given the fact of how incredibly important the placenta is, I'm assuming that placental examinations are done routinely after every delivery. Is this done? And if not, should this be done?
So the answer to that question is no, not after every delivery. So let's look at, you know, just the scope of pregnancies in our country per year. And this is in the United States. There are approximately 5 million pregnancies a year in the United States. 1 million of those end in miscarriages. Those are pregnancy losses less than 20 weeks of gestation. And the vast majority of those are in the first trimester. So it's thought that about 1 out of 4 women will have a first trimester loss, and that fits in with the statistics that I just said. So that's the vast majority, 1 million losses. There are 4 million deliveries. There are about 6 per 1,000 intrauterine fetal demises, and those are losses greater than 20 weeks. So another way of looking at that, given the numbers in our country, there are about 25,000 of those. So 25,000 is much less than the million before 20 weeks. They're far fewer, but obviously those are devastating for those families. Now, when there's a loss, clearly the placenta is looked at. But in the vast majority of pregnancies, you know, I'm trying to figure out the percentage now, 98%. If you take the 25,000 per 4 million, that's a small number. About 5% of pregnancies have some complication. And those 5%, usually the placentas are sent for pathologic examination. But the 95%, where there's no obvious problem for the newborn baby, the Apgars are good, the weight is good, you know, the kid goes to the nursery, you know, breastfeeds without any problems, those placentas are not looked at. Now, at Yale, for example, we developed a system to safeguard ourselves to make sure we catch any of the placentas that there might be a problem in the first week of life, and sometimes that happens. So the way we deal with that is the placenta gets put in a refrigerator labeled with the day of the week that it was delivered, and we save the placentas for at least 7 days. If there are no problems in the first 7 days of life, then most of the time there'll be no future problems. That isn't true. It's not zero, that percentage, but most of the time. And those placentas are then discarded as biological waste. So if we put the whole thing together, I would say at most about 10% of placentas are examined and 90% don't get examined by pathology departments.
So let's talk about that 90%. As a researcher, are you missing out? Can the placenta tell us anything about the health of a baby, even when things go well, if the pregnancy and the delivery go perfectly?
That's a great question. So the answer is yes, and part of it is a cost-benefit analysis, really, of is it cost-effective to do that? And I'll give you an example of some of the research we're doing that touches upon what you're talking about. So it's a long story, and I'm not going to tell the whole story here, but through basic research of looking at pregnancy losses and cases that had genetic abnormalities, we discovered that there's a feature in placentas that have something genetically wrong with them. And I'm just going to say it's an abnormal folding pattern of the placenta. If there are too many abnormal folds, then the pregnancy will actually end probably in the first trimester. If there are fewer, it might make it to the second, and if there are even fewer, it might make it into the third, but end sometime in the third trimester. And I've been studying this abnormality for at least 30 years at this point, and what we discovered by chance, and this is another serendipitous discovery, somebody just by chance gave me a placenta to look at from a child who had autism. And I looked at the placenta and saw the same abnormal folding pattern that I had seen with the genetically abnormal placentas. So I was surprised because at the time, this was in the early 2000s, Wakefield had just published his paper, which turned out to be completely unethical and wrong about vaccines causing autism. Families started suing their pediatricians and vaccine makers, thinking that it was the vaccine that was causing it. And because I'm asked as a consultant to look at a lot of cases, I was sent some cases of a child or children, there were several, who had autism. The families thought it was due to vaccines. And I saw this marker for genetic abnormality. So we've been working on this since about 2001 now, where we have been cataloging all the cases that we see of placentas from children with genetic abnormalities, including developmental disorders, including autism. And about, 5 years ago, in 2013, we published a paper that showed that there was a significant difference in this abnormal folding pattern in normal placentas, or let's say from neurotypical children compared to children at high risk for autism. So at the time, I proposed, and I still believe this is useful, that it might be a useful thing, especially with families that already have one child with autism or with a family history or developmental disorders, it might be useful to actually look at a placenta, even though the child appears to be normal at birth, and to diagnose this. Why is that useful? Because if a family knows the child is at increased risk for a developmental disorder, they can, one, their level of suspicion goes up if they start to see any issues. Two, if they do see any issues, they can intervene earlier. And it is known that the earlier the intervention for these children, the better the outcome. So that's one example of where it might be useful to look at placentas, even though a child appears to be normal at birth.
So we've been talking about examining placentas after a delivery, after a birth. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about during a pregnancy. Is it possible to know how well or how poorly a placenta is functioning during a pregnancy?
That's a great question. People have tried different tools to do that. And actually at Yale, this was back in the 70s and in the 80s when ultrasound started to become available, they developed a grading system for placentas, grade 0, 1, 2, and 3. And basically 3 was the worst, and 3 was a placenta that had a lot of calcifications. And their thought at the time was that if the placenta didn't look good, then maybe the blood flow wasn't as good to that placenta as a normal placenta. So that was one of the earliest attempts to look at a placenta in utero by ultrasound. And it hasn't really, it didn't catch on to become a generally clinical useful tool, but some people occasionally will do it. And sometimes if you look at a report done by maternal fetal medicine specialist, they may grade the placenta, and that's what that relates to. The other thing that happened with ultrasound over the last certainly 20 years is what's called Doppler flow, where you can actually measure the blood flow of the fetus's blood in its umbilical cord, both the arteries which are moving away from its body towards the placenta and the vein which returns blood from the placenta to the fetus's body. So some people have looked at placental function by Doppler flow of the umbilical cord. And finally, research that I'm actually involved in, we've been looking at the size of the placenta. I will just mention, and I think most people know this, that when you bring a child to a pediatrician, the first thing we do is we weigh the child, and then we have a growth chart, and we look at where that child fits in. And that's a very good way to get an overall sense of the health and well-being of that child. How well is that child growing just simply by weight? I view following a pregnancy without looking at the placenta as something like driving a car without a gas gauge. Because the problem is, just before the car runs out of gas, the car is running perfectly fine. And the same thing happens with the fetus. You can think of the gas tank as being the placenta, and when they're very small placentas, a fetus can grow up to a certain point, but all of a sudden, and it happens quite quickly, the fetus literally outstrips the ability of the placenta to support it, and you can have an intrauterine fetal demise. So I developed a method called estimated placental volume, EPV, using a very simple two-dimensional ultrasound technique, mathematical equation that actually my father, who's an engineer, helped me with. And we published this back in, I think it was 2010, was the first paper. We've now published 3 papers looking at normative curves. We now have those normative curves. And for myself, I think that this is such a simple technique that it should just be added routinely to all ultrasounds. My goal of doing this was to try to prevent women having intrauterine fetal demises due to very small placentas.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for all of your helpful analogies between the tree, the scuba divers, and the gas gauge. It really helps regular folks like me understand what you're trying to describe. Is it possible to predict or treat issues such as placental insufficiency or placental abruption, or do families struggling with these conditions just have to accept that that's happening and there's not much that can be done about it?
Well, that's a great question. Let me just slightly correct one of the things you said. You said placental insufficiency, and I know that's thrown around as a term. It turns out the placenta is literally almost never insufficient. The placenta is very efficient, and it can be very small because it's not getting enough blood from the mother. That's the main problem. Placentas are small not because usually there's something wrong with the placenta itself, but there's something wrong with the blood flow from the mother's uterus into the placenta. The placenta is part of the pregnancy, part of the fetus, and it depends on getting blood from the mother to support its growth and the growth of the fetus. Now, there are some women who the blood vessels in their uterus, and this is no fault of the woman, obviously the woman herself isn't controlling this. This is simply her body and how those blood vessels respond to the pregnancy. Sometimes those blood vessels don't open up and the placenta is too small. Now, I'm going to hold off on abruption. I just want to focus on the blood flow to the placenta issue about what can be done about it. So if we do measure and we have a small placenta, what we can and can't do depends on the gestational age. So let me try to explain that. If we see a very small placenta at 12 weeks of gestation, this is right at the end of the first trimester, there's nothing we can quote-unquote do, but in my opinion, what we need to say to that woman is the placenta is small in your pregnancy and we're going to follow you a little more closely. And it may be that she may have a loss even early in the second or mid-second trimester because of this. At least psychologically, we've helped her by giving her a heads up that this might happen. And I take care of patients directly in a clinic for pregnancy loss. The thing that is most upsetting for my patients is the sudden, unexpected surprise of a pregnancy loss. So I think all my patients have always said to me that if there was a way to get some warning, that would have been helpful. So that's the first thing. At least inform them that there's an issue that we're following. Let's move to 20 weeks. Let's say we see a small placenta 20 weeks. Well, there's really, again, nothing we can do because a fetus can't survive outside of the uterus at 20 weeks, but we might follow her more closely and, again, try to head off a problem before it turns into a loss. Once we get to 24 weeks, which is the lower limit of survivability, basically, then the equation becomes a balance between, and I'm going to summarize all of obstetrics in three words. You ready?
I'm ready.
In or out. That's all of obstetrics right there. The decision that an obstetrician is making or a maternal fetal medicine specialist is making about a particular pregnancy is trying to decide which is the best place for that fetus to be, inside the uterus or outside of the uterus. Now, every week that goes by, that equation changes and that balance changes. So let's make it an extreme. Let's get to 37 or 38 weeks. If we're at 37 or 38 weeks and we see a very small placenta, and I'm talking about a placenta that's at the 0.1 percentile, not just the 10th percentile, not the first, but the 0.1, extremely small, then we have a situation, especially if the fetus is normal size. So we look at the size of the fetus compared to the size of its placenta. And if that ratio, the normal ratio at term is about 6 to 1, normally a newborn baby is 6 times larger than its placenta. If that ratio becomes 7 to 1, 8 to 1, 9 to 1, or 10 to 1, 10 to 1 is an impending intrauterine fetal demise. I would say to that obstetrician, you need to deliver that baby immediately, because typically what happens is these women have non-stress tests, which are not very diagnostic of these problems. And I'm sure that there are probably many patients who are going to listen to this who may have experienced this very thing I'm saying. They felt decreased fetal movement. They came in. They had a non-stress test. It was normal. They went home. They came back the next day. There was an intrauterine fetal demise. The reason I invented estimated placental volume is to prevent those losses. So if someone could measure the placenta and the size and show that it's very small at a time that it's safe to deliver a baby, then there's no question about the choice of in or out. The answer is out. So the whether you're in or out depends on the gestational age and the other, you know, medical conditions of the mother and the fetus. But I'm hoping that the estimated placental volume test will be added to the thought process and the equation that's considered by the obstetrician. Now, let me deal with the abruption question, and that definitely is a cause of intrauterine fetal demise. Luckily, most abruptions don't just happen completely spontaneously. There's usually something else going on. There might be an infection. There might be a very small placenta. There might be hypertension, which is part of a process called preeclampsia. Those are some of the things that can happen. And the other final cause is some kind of trauma. Unfortunately, I see quite a few cases of automobile accidents or blunt trauma where a woman is in some situation, again, mostly a car accident, where there's enough force being added, given to her body because of the car accident, that the placenta is literally sheared off the uterus to some degree. If that happens all of a sudden and the placenta is completely sheared off, unfortunately, there's literally nothing we can do. The best thing, and I've had situations where people have been literally in front of a hospital, hit by a car, just a pedestrian who was pregnant, got her into the hospital within 5 to 10 minutes, and the fetus was still dead because that is still too much time if the placenta totally separates. So abruptions are a very difficult problem and hard to really predict unless there's an accident, and very hard to deal with once it happens unless you're right inside of a labor and delivery suite.
I'd like to just take a moment to talk a little bit more about your research, EPV. Sounds like it was almost 8 years ago since this came out. Curious to know if you have any status updates on how that's going, what this can tell a mother about her pregnancy. And just from my perspective, it sounds like it's not being utilized as much as it could be or should be. And why is it taking so long?
Wow, those are great questions. I wish I knew the answers to those questions. In general, I think it's hard to change medical practice, no matter what field you're in. People get into their patterns of what they do. People are not trained to do EPV as part of their, you know, education in obstetrics or maternal fetal medicine. And a lot of times, and I'm not personally meaning to do this to doctors, a lot of times when you suggest doing something, it makes them feel like, well, why do I need to do this? Are you suggesting that I'm not a good doctor now? Why aren't the things that I do right now good enough? And I get pushback from people, physicians, I should say, because of this issue. So that's why I've tried to actually enlist the help of patients directly. We developed something called the EPV Research Kit app. This is something that's available on my website. If you make the link available to your listeners, they may find it of use. And this is basically an iPhone app. The Research Kit tool is developed by Apple Computer for iPhones and iPads, and patients can go to their doctors if they're pregnant and basically request them to do this measurement. And doing this research would be helpful to us because part of the barrier that I've identified is, yes, the technique is very simple, but the doctors say, well, you haven't proven that it actually helps with outcomes. So that's the catch-22 that I'm in. I have a technique that's very simple. It takes 30 to 60 seconds to do it. It, in my opinion, should be done every time a woman has an ultrasound at any time she's pregnant. It works from first all the way up to 40 weeks of pregnancy, first trimester all the way up to 40 weeks. And I don't know why they don't do it, but I think it's not just habit, it's what they're trained to do and not trained to do. And this is something that isn't part of their training. So we try. We've just published another paper about a month ago, just came out on our data from Yale, and I'm trying in my own way, but there's only so much a single person can do.
Well, on behalf of the Star Legacy Foundation and lost families across the country. I want to thank you for all that you're doing, and also want to thank you for taking time to appear on the podcast today.
No, it's been my pleasure, and if any patient wants to contact me for either a loss that's already occurred or issues during a pregnancy, have them just go to my website. My Yale email is there, and I'd be happy to help them in any way I can.
Thanks, Dr. Kleiman. That's all for this episode of the Stillbirth Matters podcast, presented by the Star Legacy Foundation. Learn more at starlegacyfoundation.org. I'm Chris Duffy. Thanks for listening.